I'm Bea Cupin, and you're watching 36 Years, where we talk about Philippine news, politics, and democracy. On May 9, the Philippines elected Ferdinand Marcos Jr. as president. He is the second Marcos to hold the post, the first being his father, the dictator who was ousted from power on February 25, 1986, in what we now call the People Power Revolution. That was 36 years ago. Here we try to answer the question, where is Philippine democracy heading 36 years after the revolution? Welcome to 36 Years, available on Rappler social media pages and on wherever you listen to podcasts. Fresh off his first state visit to Indonesia and Singapore, President Marcos is set to travel overseas yet again. This time, he's set to fly to New York in the United States for the 77th United Nations General Assembly, or the UNGA, or the UNGA. And as with most other countries and major cities, New York and the Marcos name carry with them history and tons of baggage. In New York City, the Marcos clan, during the first Marcos president, spent millions in our money on buildings, financial assets, expensive apartments, and shopping sprees. Decades after those spending sprees, Marcos Jr. is set to address the UNGA, his first formal event with the international community as the second Marcos president. His address is set to take place on the 20th in New York, days ahead of when the first Marcos president placed the Philippines under martial rule. We are approaching the 100th day of the second Marcos administration, and frankly, we, or at least I, although to a lesser extent, still struggle to make sense of what it means to have another Marcos as president. That's why this podcast exists. To help us make sense of this, his upcoming visit to New York and the baggage of the Marcos name and the martial law years, and as a way to remember those years, we speak to a lawyer who is an expert on human rights and international law. Attorney Roscoe Tugade is a lecturer at both the UP College of Law and the Ateneo de Manila Political Science Department. Ross is also a legal analyst for Partners in Justice International. But first, the headlines. President Marcos is set to address the 77th UNGA in New York. He's also expected to have several side meetings and events while he's in the city that never sleeps. I'll be there to cover the president, so tune in to Rappler for the latest updates from New York City. Marcos has signed Executive Order No. 3, which makes mask wearing outdoors optional. The EO follows a recommendation from an interagency body to lift the mask mandate for outdoor settings that are well ventilated. Emphasis on outdoor settings, no well ventilated. But the elderly and the immunocompromised are encouraged but not required to keep their masks on even outdoors. Health experts have opposed this move, saying it sends the wrong message to Filipinos that COVID-19 is no longer something to be afraid of. It is, in fact, something we, you, I should be still vigilant about. This isn't the podcast to talk about this exactly, but studies on long COVID paint a rather alarming picture of what people who experience symptoms long after initial infection have to deal with. And I say this as someone who has dealt with COVID and has dealt with symptoms that lingered long after initial infection. EO3 or not, personally, I'll be keeping my mask on, even outdoors. If you're listening to this and if you're already eligible, please get your booster shots as soon as you ulit. Soon, 3, 2, 1. EO3 or not, personally, I'll be keeping my mask on, even if I'm outdoors. If you're listening to this and if you're already eligible, please get your booster shots as soon as you can. Those are the headlines. Now on to the interview. Hi, Ross. Thank you for joining us.
Magandang araw. Salamat din sa imbitasyon.
Okay. So, one of the reasons why we want to talk about martial law again, specifically in this episode, no? Because this month, we are commemorating and remembering, though for some individuals and sectors who are in power right now, the world will be celebrating the anniversary of the Declaration of Martial Law. And I apologize if this is my first question to you. Bungad pa lang ng interview na to. How have you personally made sense of the fact that on the 50th anniversary of the declaration of martial rule in the country, the dictator son, the son of the man who placed us under martial law, is the sitting president of the Philippines?
I think it's been a long time coming yung historical reckoning natin of the legacy of martial law, and connected to that, the legacy of the post-EDSA Republic, no? And of course, kakabit noon, how we have taken stock of those separate but also connected legacies. Ang komplikado ng emotions, no, na nararamdaman natin ngayon, and I could imagine it especially for the survivors of martial law, no, na it's very complex because you have to also take into account what were the gains as well as the losses after the 86 revolution and the institution of the post-EDSA Republic.
Yeah. You talk about, I want to, syempre we'll touch on the victims, survivors, those who suffered the most under martial law. Pero I want to zoom in muna on the gains and the losses. A lot has been said. In fact, one of the first interviews under this podcast was with Larry Claudio, who for a while, I mean, one of his major focuses sa study niya, no, yung how EDSA, the revolution, was perceived in the aftermath. How have you come to terms, and this is leading, connecting to another question that I listed down, no, parang, because ours is the generation that, like I said in one episode also, we were born in the direct aftermath of the revolution. Like, hindi natin naabutan yung suffering. We barely remember the struggles of a post-EDSA Philippines, right? Like, we were, wala pa tayong words. Literally, hindi pa tayo nakakapagsalita. Wala pa tayong thoughts na. So, through the years, how do you think we've come to terms with understanding the gains and the losses in the post-EDSA era or in the aftermath of the revolution?
Of course, yung tangible na gains nun is in some scholarly accounts, it's the restoration of democracy. It's the restoration of democratic institutions, of the electoral system, of having free and fair elections again. But we have to nuance that a bit and then see if the restoration of democracy was indeed a revival of democratic ideas or just institutional in its form. Kumbaga, did it also come with the restoration of the elites that dominated the pre-martial law and pre-EDSA Republic? Yeah. So, mahalaga rin tignan natin yon. And ako personally, as someone who grew up in the solid north, although my dad was an activist, my mom is Ilocana, I grew up in a household that had a lot of awareness regarding the immediate history nung, at least at the time when I was born 1990, so that was 4 years after the EDSA revolution. My personal learnings were from the stories of my parents, no? And also yung popular media during the 90s. Naalala ko tuwing September or February, no, yung mga documentaries like Batas Militar would always air on free TV. Yeah. That shaped a lot of my political awakening, especially for someone who didn't live through the martial law era and didn't witness its revolution. So a lot of popular media shaped my perception of martial law and the 86 revolution. But now we're seeing a shift, no? A shift in how there has been a downplaying of the atrocities and a sanitized version of the historical record, either through pedagogy or even through popular culture, no? We have that film which made the headlines a month ago, couple of months ago. And that's an example of how powerful popular media is in shaping the historical record.
Yeah. This is something that I also discussed with other previous guests, no, na parang on top of that movie, na on a technical level, bumenta siya. But then we also saw anecdotes and evidence na may pagpapakyaw na nangyari. Pero ibang podcast yan at ibang topic yan altogether. But just to add to that, di ba, parang things that maybe were below or were under our radars because baka the algorithm didn't feed it to us. But through the years, via YouTube, via TikTok pala, hindi pala in years. Year pa, 1 or 2 years pa lang pala yung TikTok na talagang uso. Pero YouTube, Facebook, even Twitter, but not as successfully, di ba? Parang these short videos slowly revising history, questioning what little we learned in history class. Kasi I think you have a very, very privileged and fortunate upbringing in that your parents were very much conscious about teaching you about history. That's not, unfortunately, that's not something a lot of most people in our age bracket, minsan nga, regardless of socioeconomic status, no, parang it's not an exposure that many were given. And I guess that's one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why we are where we are now. Isa pang layer dyan sa pagkamulat mo siguro, di ba? Ross, you work in the Human Rights Victims Claims Board with directly or in tangentially too?
Quite directly, no? May mga araw na ako, iniiyakan ako ng mga biktima.
Oh my God.
May mga araw na I have to personally interview the survivors' families. So, ang bigat yung naging trabaho. Although, kwento ko lang, no, na I came in at a time, it was my first year as a lawyer, bagong pa sa ako.
Oh my gosh!
Yes, that was my first job.
What an awakening!
Yes, I was in for a surprise, no? I came in actually late in the process na because the law was passed, 10368 was passed, if I'm not mistaken, 2013. And I came in 2017, so natapos na yung intake ng victims sa testimonies, ng reception of evidence. So the heavy lifting was actually done by my colleagues who were the pioneer staff and the early staff of the HRVCB. No, they went around the Philippines and gathered the accounts of the martial law survivor. So nandun na ako sa part na nag-adjudicate na kami. We were resolving claims, we were resolving appeals also, no. So that was the context in which I worked. Pero may mga araw, especially nung patapos na kami, no, because as you know, may sunset clause yung RA 10368 that they had to close shop by 2018, no. Nung patapos na kami, ang daming mga nabalitaan lang nila na meron palang ganitong mekanismo, no? Interview na ako and I had to turn them down and say tapos na po yung intake period, nag-adjudicate na po kami ng claims, magsasara na po kami. So that was the personal personal difficulty I had when I was doing that kind of work, no, yung bigat ng historical experience and the personal experience that they carry with them up to this day, kailangan mong makinig. Hindi po pwedeng, you know, you just give them the technicality of the law and then leave them at that, because these are the survivors of mass atrocities and these are the survivors of grave human rights abuses. So that was, in a nutshell, my experience working personally in the HRVCB.
Yeah. And I think something that's not always discussed is that this trauma unfortunately doesn't end with the person who was literally physically or psychologically harmed. Oftentimes, traumas like this is passed on to generations even, right? And I mean, ako, personally, I want to thank you for doing that yourself and having to go through that. I'm sure it was quite a rude awakening for a young, and I would assume very, very optimistic and bright-eyed young lawyer.
Oh.
Yeah.
It was my first job out of law school. Siyempre, pag out of law school ka, ang isipin mo, you're
change the world.
world. Yes, exactly. And reality struck me very quickly and quite deeply, no? Na it, na ito yung dating nababasa ko lang in the history yeah. textbook that I've read in high school and college. Ito yung mga kwento lang sa akin, but once I got to read the witness yeah. statements, I got to interact with the victims themselves, ang lalim ng karanasan na hindi makakapture ng kahit anong written historical record. And the depth, the expanse of the abuse that happened during martial law, bearing in mind that this mechanism was the first of its kind, no? And still, the only quasi-judicial body for reparations in existence in the Philippines, well, tapos na siya, pero that had been existence in the Philippines. Nangangapa kami noon na hindi namin alam yung certain procedures for certain things. Ang daming karanasan din, no, especially for the people who worked there. Na kwento ko lang din na puro bata yung staff namin noon. Law students mostly ang paralegals namin noon. So imagine how it was for them na very mas siguro mas idealistic pa sa akin, no? Mas wide-eyed pa kaysa sa akin, and you have them yeah. working day and night. May mga pagkakataon na nandun kami sa office until 3 in the morning. Uuwi lang ako yeah. para maligo at magpalit, and then babalik ulit. Because we were in a race against time, no? Dahil nga merong deadline yung Human Rights Victims Claims Board. So, yeah. it's an experience that surely made a mark on me personally, and as well as yeah. the lives of the people who we've worked with, and also the younger people na nagsilbi dun sa Human Rights Claims Board.
Yeah, and syempre kung bigger picture pa dito, diba? Like, it's legislation that says explicitly there yes. were victims of martial law, and they do deserve compensation. Which leads me to another question. No? When we say justice and reparations and compensation, in the context of the victims of martial law under the first Marcos president, and to extend to that, a more recent history for us, the killings under Duterte's drug war, which I know that you were also very much involved in and researched on and studied. What does that mean exactly? Kung sinasabi natin gusto natin ng hustisya, ano bang ibig sabihin nun? Kasi for some people, justice can be a very vague concept, sadly, because justice in the Philippine context is not always something that's even real to a lot of Filipinos, right?
Yeah. At gusto ko sinabi mo na I was also involved in the drug war. Bumingo na talaga ako.
In that parang sense, hindi pa sapat na, you know, you went through learning firsthand the experience of victims of the martial law era. Gusto mo din the second.
So that has been largely the narrative of my professional life, though, working yeah. in context of mass atrocities. But to go to your question, what we try to forward nung nagtrabaho na ako eventually sa Commission on Human Rights is an agenda for what we call transitional justice. Okay. Transitional yeah. justice is it's a subfield that's largely studied in post-authoritarian, post-conflict situations, na ito yung klase ng hustisya na gusto maatim ng mga biktima ng grave mass atrocities or grave crimes, no? And when we talk about transitional justice, no, so you're talking about transition from one kind of regime to another. So in the context of martial law, it's a transition from an authoritarian dictatorial regime to democracy. What kind of institutional mechanisms, what kind of reforms did we have to put in place when the time came that we had to transition? So yeah. in broad strokes, that's what transitional justice yeah. is. But transitional justice is held up by four pillars, recognized yan, four pillars, but there's a fifth pillar that's emerging. So the pillars are right to truth. This comes in the form of finding out what happened, setting straight the historical account. In some countries, for example, in South Africa, there's the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, post-apartheid. They had that. And then also, you have the right to justice, which comes in the form mainly of criminal accountability. But sadly, in the Philippines, we weren't able to fully achieve no yung criminal accountability for the prosecution of human rights abuses. Although we have connected dun sa pangatlong pillar, the right to reparation, which was mainly the function of the Human Rights Victims Claims Board through RA 10368. Although I have to point out that the reparations came in the form of individual monetary and non-monetary reparations. First, the monetary reparations came from the sequestered funds, which had been deposited to the Treasury. Tapos yun yung ginamit na pondo para sa reparations. We also had non-monetary reparations in the form of assistance from the different government agencies. And then the fourth pillar would be institutional mechanisms, no? Institutional reform, rather. Institutional reform naman would come in the form of, for example, creating institutions that would address the past, no? So ito yung tinatawag na right to make sure that there is non-recurrence, what we call guarantees of non-repetition or non-recurrence. So medyo now that I think of it, no, napapaisip ako if we actually instituted guarantees of non-recurrence enough to make sure that these things wouldn't happen again. And the fifth emerging pillar is the right to memorialization, which is to remember, not just to set the historical record straight, but to remember and to make markers, no, physical markers or symbolic markers of the atrocities that happened. And magkakakabit ito, no? So ito yung holistic na pagtingin sa justicia from the lens of transitional justice. And from our experience after martial law, reparations came at a much later time, no? Sa panahon na ni President Noynoy Aquino. And the reparations didn't even account for what is called a collective reparation, so restoring communities, no. Kumbaga, it felt a bit short on that, although merong monetary reparations na nabigay. As I've mentioned also, yung ibang mekanismo, right to truth, being renegotiated and contested yung katotohanan tungkol sa martial law. So I don't think from the lens of transitional justice, we've quite achieved a holistic form of
justice. Yeah. Yeah. No, because as I was listening to you and going through the five pillars that you mentioned, parang fading grade tayo in most, if not all of these. I mean, truth palang, especially truth, right? You saw efforts in the last 50 decades, five decades rather, to, you know, create that, to establish the narrative, the complete narrative. And yes, parang yun yung kasi yung argument ng mga tao, di ba? Hindi nyo kasi pinapakinggan yung other side nila. Pinapakinggan nga, pero sinasabi natin, mas importante yung kwento ng mga nadehado. Like, di ba, parang, boohoo, you were ousted out of power. Yeah. Let's look at the stories that matter more. The tens of thousands were victimized. Which leads me to that question. Like I mentioned earlier, no, parang ours is a generation. We didn't go through martial law. Our education on it was inconsistent. For some of us, it was much better. For others, it did not exist. Literally, isang pahina lang sa history books ng ibang estudyante yung nagka-martial law, period, yun lang. And then to add to that, we saw the rise of disinformation. Initially, the focus, I guess, because it was a Duterte, President Rodrigo Duterte was in power in the past 6 years, was the Duterte disinformation. But we also saw the slow creeping rise of Marcos disinformation. And it's been argued nga na technically, hindi lang to 10 years na rehabilitation project. Yeah. Nagsimula yung rehab ng Marcos name in 1986 pa lang. Dun pa lang. Unti-unti na lang sinimulan. So you have that context. How can one be a human rights defender in this environment? In the environment that we inherit from Rodrigo Duterte, in the environment that Ferdinand Marcos Jr. is stepping into, and in the environment that pushed him back to Malacañang in a way, di ba?
Ako, first thing we have to take into account, the survivors of martial law are reaching an advanced age. Diba? Yeah. Yung straight from the horse's mouth narrative na ito yung naranasan namin. That's a generation that's slowly we're losing, no? Tumatanda na sila, yung iba pumanaw na. And so we have to consider the fact that the torch is being passed on to us now. Sa ating mga maaari hindi nakaranas ng martial law, hindi nakaranas nung victory of the people during the EDSA revolution. Importante to uphold the historical fact and to ensure that we never forget. And to just respond to the question of how does one become a human rights defender today? Ang hirap, no? Ang hirap. But I guess it starts with educating oneself. Yung hindi lang academic education, but also education in terms of historical experiences and the plight of the people whom we seek to serve. Kailangan makipag-usap sa komunidad, kailangan talagang malaman natin yung accounts of people who are continuing the struggle, no? Yung mga patuloy na nagiging biktima ng karahasan, nagiging biktima ng pang-aabuso sa kanilang mga karapatang pantao. So mahalaga 'yon na we keep ourselves educated on those different facets to speak up. And of course, syempre mahalaga yung mag-iingat din tayo in the sense of we have an environment that's quite hostile to dissent and opposition, no? So, point out ko lang that the Commission on Human Rights came out with actually a report on the state of human rights defenders, I think a couple of years ago. And they described in that report the threats being faced by human rights defenders today. But as what I always answer when people ask me why I continue to do the work I do, or if you ask anyone who is doing the same kind of work, siguro isa sa magiging sagot dyan, someone has to do it. Kung hindi tayo kikilos, di natin ipapahayag yung dissent natin on what's happening, especially to the marginalized. Ang kauuwian natin sa kasaysayan? So, it's difficult. It's a difficult path to take. But certainly, it's one that's historically necessary sa tingin ko.
Thank you for that reminder on listening to the people that we seek to serve. And I think it's a good reminder, not just for people who specifically work in the field of human rights or journalism even, or politics. Kahit yung mga siguro unti-unti are being more aware of political realities and not just electoral. Some people kasi conflate political with just the electoral process or partisan politics. Pero to always listen to the people that you, in their case, you're not necessarily seek to serve, but you seek to address, whose concerns you seek to address or you want to dialogue with. Because I think people tend to forget, or it's easy to forget, na once you refuse to listen or half-listening ka lang, yung compliance lang na pinapakinggan mo kunwari, you tend to talk over people. And when you do that, you isolate them. And in a way, I don't want to say that this doesn't absolve them from disinformation or spreading disinformation themselves. Pero when you're not listened to, it's quite easy to fall into the trap of disinformation kasi the people who do these things, man, like, magaling sila, either they know how to listen or they know how to pretend how to listen. And they're beating us in that aspect. And that's something that we have to contend with, sadly. No?
Yeah, for sure. Ako, I occasionally browse TikTok, no? And for some reason, nakakagip pa rin ako ng algorithm, no? Nung yung obvious talaga na nagkakalat ng disinformation. And gulat nga ako, meron mang fan cams of certain political figures. And it's like they're being fashioned as idols, no? Yeah. Like what we do for K-pop idols. And Grabe yung, the first time I saw one of those, grabe yung shock ko. And then I realized, ito na, I guess, yung battleground and yung kalakaran na yun. We can't entirely dismiss the fact that a lot of young people are watching these things. A lot of people are listening to these things. And they're at that age when they're facing a lot of existential questions, a lot of inquiries being made as to the world out there. And it's our task to know where they're coming from, but also it's our task to uphold again the historical record, no? Not just for the sake of institutional memory, but also I guess for the sake of the people who suffered those abuses and those atrocities. Para sa kanila naman talaga yung pag-alala natin kung bakit tayo nagko-commemorate solemnly every year ng mga ganitong klaseng events that happened in history.
Yeah. I mean, I think for us who put premium on democracy and memory, parang we have to, a lot of us do already accept this na it's like we're living in two realities and our mission, our goal should be to bring people back together into one reality. Because it's like parallel worlds talaga. Parang yun nga, TikTok I think is a friend, a common friend of ours, who was once referred it as a hellhole and a rabbit hole, which I think is an app description of TikTok app. And that's, it's through the ingenious and frankly scary FYP where you see na talagang parallel worlds are being created. And thank you for bringing up nga yung parang the I don't know what the figures are in the Philippine context, pero globally TikTok I think the second biggest audience. Would you believe na millennial na ata yung bigger audience ng TikTok?
Wow, for the Gen Z.
We have taken over it, sadly, for Gen Z. But Gen Z is the second biggest. And if you think about it, because now that I reflect on my younger years, those were my formative years in terms of building my moral compass, presuming I have one. yung pinaka-base ng values ko. And it's difficult to unlearn those things that you learn in your early 20s. And your teens, di ba? So, you have to reach out to them.
Until now, ang dami kong ina-unlearn ng mga bagay na natutunan ko at that age in terms of values, in terms of opinions, no? It's a constant struggle to have to unlearn those things. And I think the privilege that I have is I'm surrounded by people who can call me out or people who can set the record straight for me. But when you have kids left to their own devices, quite literally, looking at things that are targeted at spreading misinformation, then what kind of future are we looking at, no? What kind of writing of history are we going to anticipate in the next few years? So it's quite scary. Dahil hindi lang naman to use that very tired trope, hindi lang naman chismis yan, di ba? It's what happened, and people through generations have suffered.
Ross, as someone who's dealt with or has experience in the different pillars of transitional justice, parang the way I frame this question might be hilariously simple, but why is it so difficult? Maybe in this specific context of the Philippines, and I think this also lays down the, gives us a more realistic future, kasi parang mostly we'll talk about, this is probably in the context of your experience of dealing with the martial reparations, pero looking forward, I think it's time we talk about also paano naman yung mga biktima ng drug war ni Rodrigo Duterte. Yeah. Bakit ba ang hirap-hirap? Bakit parang step one or isang pillar pa lang? Diyos ko, truth pa lang, parang hirap na tayo. And this is even before the emergence of disinformation on social media, right? Like, we're talking about struggles of the truth in old school disinformation, di ba?
Yeah. Sa tingin ko, if we look at the martial law example, where we fell short, I guess, it was concentrated on the formal institutional mechanisms, but not so much on social and cultural institutions. So you have, for example, you have the PCGG. Okay, it's there. You have the Commission on Human Rights. It's there. You have these institutions working for you. But what about taking care of what happens outside those formal institutions, the informal institutions? Yeah. Sakto, ito yung lecture ko kanina sa class ko. No? We have formal and informal institutions. And the informal institutions are the ones that are actually more pervasive in our everyday lives. No? How about your civic education? Naalagaan ba natin yun in the aftermath of martial law? And in the same vein, when we are going to talk about the drug war, ang daming entanglements yan, no, na kailangan talaga nating himayin. You have the slow grind of justice for victims, and even yung victims nga wouldn't even trust the justice system to give them, to dispense some form of justice that is although not commensurate, certainly hindi mapapalitan yung buhay ng kaanak nilang namatay, but at least something that honors the dignity of the lives that were lost during the drug war. We've yet to see how that pans out, but I guess we have to learn from the lessons of martial law, how we communicate human rights education, how we communicate the atrocity, the history of grave atrocities and grave crimes to future generations. Parang matuto naman tayo sa nangyari sa kasaysayan, and it's our hope that justice in a form that's very honoring of the dignity of the lives of those who were lost in the drug war would be in our grasp this time around.
Which is a tall order considering that the current education secretary is the daughter of the previous president and the incumbent vice president. That's another topic altogether kung the reality of national politics in the Philippines. Ross Susi, President Marcos is set to address the UNGA, ONGA, as our foreign colleagues would call it. Hindi ko talagang matanggap na ONGA ang tawag. Parang to the Filipino tongue, it sounds very strange. UNGA. He will be addressing the UNGA on September 20. It's unlikely that he'll talk about human rights in the context of martial law victims, obviously, although tumbling tayo lahat if he does that. Which will probably make other people, including me, wonder, ano ba ang silbi ng UN? Ano ba ang silbi ng itong mga bodies na ito that are designed to address issues that concern the international community?
So institutional, if you look at the institutional history of the UN, it's really there to make sure that another catastrophic war doesn't happen ever again. And one of the pillars of the UN Charter is the respect for dignity of the human person and respect for human rights as a set of universal principles. So the UN is there to make sure na hindi na mangyayari yung naulit, no, ay yung at hindi na mauulit or hindi na mangyayari yung karanasan natin during the two world wars, no. That's in the broad strokes function of the UN, to make sure that there's a peace and security internationally. But I'd like to draw your attention to the UN Human Rights Council and the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. They've periodically, may mga reports silang nilalabas. I think in June 2020, they came out with quite a lengthy report called From the Narratives of Different Civil Society Groups. Also, meron ding Universal Periodic Review from different states, no? They come out with these reports that detail the human rights situation in each country. And meron ding mekanismo sa Human Rights Council to hear kumbaga complaints against states. And point out ko lang din that there was a communication sent to the UNHRC several years ago regarding the right to an effective remedy with respect to the claims of martial law victims. I think it was the Pimentel communication, Pimentel versus the Philippines yata ang title nun, if I'm not mistaken. Basically, they were saying na we've been deprived of our right to an effective remedy kasi antagal ma-recognize ng foreign judgments. It took, 8 years just to settle the issue of filing fees before the courts, and that effectively deprived the claimants, no, those who were the plaintiffs who sued in foreign courts, their right to compensation from the foreign adjudicated cases. So in terms of martial law, may ganong historical tidbit na dapat nating malaman, no? And the mechanisms are there naman. Of course, this is an international body still subject to politics and international relations. So a lot of diplomacy involved, a lot of politics involved.
Yeah. Ross, going back to coming to terms or like attempting to make amends with those who were victimized during martial law, based on your own experience in the Human Rights Victims Claim Board and experience in other interactions with people who suffered because of the states or specifically a president's policy and decisions, ano yung gains, ano yung kulang pa doon sa batas na iyon that did create the Human Rights Victims Claims Board?
I think the most important gain there is the explicit recognition.
Yeah.
The explicit recognition that this happened during this period of time and that it was the result of martial law and it led to a lot of human rights abuses. I think that's the most important facet of RA 10368. Kahit nasabihin mong nag-sunset clause na wala ng HRBCB
yeah.
Yeah. To put it out there in law,
yeah.
Na meron kang legal recognition of the rights of these victims to reparation and their right to being recognized as victims, that's really, really important, and not just on a symbolic level, but for our nation's history as well, no? And of course, the evidence gathered by the board during its life, it surfaces the depth and the expanse of the abuses. Makikita dun sa archives, siguro kung may opportunity to look at the archives, but from the evidence I saw when I was working there, makikita mo yung which units committed abuses in which period of time and in what geographical location, what kind of atrocities were committed. Hindi lang killing, hindi lang torture, there was sexual abuse, there was arbitrary detention, there was arbitrary arrest, there was detention of children na hindi masyadong nakikita doon sa siguro mainstream accounts, and these are the very personal accounts of victims, no? Siguro I think those are the gains, but if I may just discuss siguro yung mga shortcomings or where it fell short, siguro yung lack of time, you know, na yung there was a built-in sunset clause, and 4 years is not enough, I think, to adjudicate all of the claims. 75,000 plus claimants came before the board. 11,000 plus were given reparations. That is but a snapshot, I think, of the extent of the abuses during martial law. Tas yun nga, since it was the first of its kind, procedurally there were a lot of things that we had to learn quickly dahil wala nang oras. Tapos nandun pa yung fact na we don't have any model regional body in Southeast Asia, for example, na Human Rights Court. Wala naman tayong katulad sa Europe na European Court of Human Rights. Wala rin tayong Inter-American Court of Human Rights para sa Americas, no? We don't have that kind of model. So it was really a novel institution. And with every novel institution, steep yung learning curve. no? But yeah, there's a lot of work to be done kasi nandun din sa batas sa 10368 yung memorialization, and we've yet to see the museum to be built out of the funds also. So we've yet to see if that will come into fruition.
Yeah. And I think that leads to my next question, which is what more should be done? I recall that chinacheck ko actually kanina ko anong taon ba yun, kasi pandemic yun eh. Eh yung pandemic nagmo-merge. 2021 lang pala yun nag-interview kayo ni Lian about yung paper niyo proposing a memory law that would make that would prohibit denying atrocities during Marcos's martial law illegal. Paano yun? Okay. Andito tayo sa context na the second Ferdinand Marcos is president. Dagdag mo pa ang dami ng Ferdinands holding major posts in government. You have a speaker, Ferdinand Martin Romualdez. You have a senior deputy majority leader Sandro Ferdinand Alexander Marcos. What more should be done, and what can we do given this political context that hindi lang that Marcos is back in Malacañang, but Marcos and his, you know, like his hindi lang allies, relatives hold key positions in key institutions in politics. Kasi if you're talking about passing legislation, you have Speaker Romualdez who calls, in effect, calls the shots in the House of the 19th Congress.
And in fact, we're seeing the opposite, diba? Merong bill na Ferdinand Marcos Day, may bill na renaming MMSU to FEMSU.
Recently,
very recent yun na, and yun nga yun kay Representative Abante, yung abolition of the PCGG. So, the opposite of what we should have aspired for many years ago is happening right now. And kung hindi, like I said a while ago, it goes hand in hand, though, your formal institutions mo and your informal institutions. If we cannot, if our chances are slim in passing legislation or any kind of policy that addresses historical revisionism, at the very least, we hold the fort in our civic institutions, no? In our social cultural institutions. Dun tayo, I guess, mag-focus if we can't. Of course, we will still do our best when it comes to formal institutions. But we have to learn from our experience, from our historical experience, and really focus on what's happening in our day-to-day lives when it comes to discussing historical revisionism and the renegotiation of history.
And on that, hindi naman siya sobrang bleak, no? Pero at least actionable points yun moving forward. My last question is a question I ask everyone who guests on 36 Years. Kasi this podcast, this show is about making sense of where we are by understanding where we've come from. Ikaw, when you try to understand the reality of your own life or of Philippine politics as a whole, like, what do you do? What do you watch, listen to, read when you want to not escape from reality, but when you want to try to better understand the reality around you?
Hirap naman nung tanong, no? Kasi I consume a lot of pop culture, but I guess I go back to a quiet place of contemplation and just read poetry. I think that's any kind of poet, you know. I think we need that form of tenderness and gentleness in our lives as a good contrast to the harsh reality that we're facing now. So I guess it doesn't hurt to imagine a softer world through words and through the hopes and aspirations of those who have come before.
Ang ganda ng tenderness in a world that's anything but. Thank you again, Ross, for your time, and thank you for joining us.
Salamat din.
And that has been this week's episode of 36 Years. Again, I'd like to thank Attorney Ross Togati for the time spent with us. Watch out for our updates on Rappler.com on President Marcos's visit to New York. This has been Bea Cupin. Thank you for watching.